Hello, and welcome to On the Other Hand, a podcast that explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through conversations with community leaders in Arkansas. I'm your host, Glenn White. In our last two conversations with Jerry Henderson, we've tackled the incredibly complicated but fascinating topic of political polarization. We've looked into what research and experts tell us about that topic, and we've explored to some degree what polarization is defined as, and we've looked into a little bit of the history of polarization in this country. We also have explored some of the key causes and influences on polarization, and today we'll be continuing that, finishing that up, and then moving into the impact of media and social media on polarization. We'll also talk about misinformation and disinformation and how that contributes to polarization. We'll also briefly highlight how the brain can make it difficult for us to think rationally and make decisions in politics that are based on our values. April, for those of you who miss her, she will return in our later interviews. She missed out when we were talking with Jerry, but we look forward to her insightful contributions with future guests. So let's get back to hearing more about influences on polarization. Okay, as we continue this discussion of political polarization and what the research and opinion leaders have to say, I'm joined by Jerry Henderson. This is Glenn White, and I wanted to get into the whole issue of various causes and influences on polarization. And as I mentioned in the last episode, things are really complicated in this area. Jerry and I both have done some considerable diving into the research literature, and it's incredible the amount of different things that make a difference that impact polarization and one's beliefs and whether or not you change your beliefs. So we're going to get into that now. So Jerry, I thought a good place to start is to talk about the influence of social modeling. Now, I'm sure you remember, you know, from the old psychology stuff, and maybe some of our listeners do too, that social modeling is the idea that you learn from observing what other people are doing.
Yeah.
The very strong, powerful way of learning, which is incidentally why you tell people that are parents, this idea of do as I say, not as I do, is not going to work. You have to really demonstrate and act out what you want your kids to do because it's such a powerful form of learning. Well, it's not just true for kids, it's true for adults as well. So in the context of political polarization, it's important to look at not only what we're learning from the people that we know, like our family and friends, but also in this day of media exposure, people who are famous, our leaders, the politicians, the folks who show up on the news and on the, the internet feed, that sort of thing, social media. So this social modeling, let me give you an example of where this started from. Jerry, do you remember the old thing you learned in graduate school about Bandura, the psychologist who did the experiments with Bobo dolls?
And the aggression. And
yeah, yeah.
Sure.
So for those who may not recall that or haven't been exposed to it, and I'll probably butcher this terribly, so help me out if you remember something different, Jerry, but the idea was that they did research with young kids. They would be together in a room, and there was people behind, psychologists behind the mirror, observing them and filming them and recording their behavior, and they would have an adult come in there. Now, they had lots of different things for the kids to play with, and one of the things they had was called a Bobo doll at the time, which is kind of an inflated plastic, almost human-sized doll that was kind of heavy on the bottom, and so it kind of stood up, as you will, and if you pushed it, it would kind of teeter over and then come back up. Well, the experimenter had an adult go into the room at some point. They were recording the behavior of the kids, and they were particularly noting how aggressive their play was and what they did with the toys and the objects in the room. And then they had the adult go in and start playing with the Bobo doll and punching it a lot, being really aggressive with the Bobo doll. And then the adult leaves, and they continued to collect the data on what the kids were doing. The kids were beginning to show more aggressive behavior, and particularly with the Bobo doll. It was like they saw the adult do it and said, oh, that's cool, I'll do that too. And so they saw a lot of that. You remember that
sure.
research?
Yeah.
Anything else you remember from specific about that?
Well, it's informative how quickly the aggressive tendencies shown by the adult was picked up by the youngsters.
Yeah. So that was one of the early versions of understanding about social modeling, but we also know that it's true. It influences the behavior and attitudes of adults as well.
Sure.
We may not be beating up on Bobo dolls, but if we're castigating and saying bad things about our political opponents, guess what? That's having an impact on the populace as well, those who listen to them. And that's why we're talking about this in terms of polarization. So as a result, one of the things that I think is really important is to look at the influence of our leaders and our politicians, those who are willing to exploit existing divisions in this polarized society, and also who maybe try to manipulate the voters with fear and anger toward the opposition party. That's going to have an impact on the people who follow them, and to a degree it's likely to have an impact on even others who don't necessarily agree with their standards. So it suggests that if you have people in power or of any kind of public influence, maybe it's just someone who has a strong media presence, if they act badly, that tends to facilitate more people acting in a similar bad fashion, because now it's seen as more acceptable. And that's one of the things I understand about it, is that it's, you know, the other people may, there are people out there that may have the tendency and propensity toward acting aggressively or badly, but if the peer pressure is, and the modeling is that we don't do that, a lot of people are inhibited from acting that way. But when you have someone in the public sphere that acts this bad way, and you see that demonstrated, and particularly if it doesn't get punished, they get away with it, or even reinforced for it, that is kind of giving tacit permission to people at large to act in the same way. And that's one of the things that I worry about that's happening right now.
Yeah, I agree, Glenn. And there's, I can't think of the person's name, but back in the 80s, there was a lot of look at what they called the window of acceptable rhetoric in politics. And if you were outside that window, you didn't have much of a chance to get elected. Hmm. But that window could be stretched in either direction, more conservative or further to the right or further to the left, dependent on what politicians were saying and doing. And I think it kind of fits in with that, because there's some suggestion that there is attempt to stretch the window to allow more hardball politics, you know. So once they break the window and start talking in these vicious terms, it's open.
Yeah. And there's another notion in social psychology called social contagion that's really important here, that I think the social modeling is part of the thing going on here. But it's basically the idea, and I think we've seen this before, you know how there are fads in society?
Sure.
And some of those fads are kind of harmless. What was it? Remember the pet rocks?
Oh, yeah.
back in the 70s. But there are also negative ones where people start acting in kind of nasty, mean, aggressive ways. And when that gets some publicity and people observe that, other people start copying that behavior. Same thing might be true for the way people believe, the beliefs they espouse. But this social contagion notion is that in the right circumstances, that type of behavior or belief system can spread like an infectious disease. So it's analogous to, let's say, a pandemic, you know, that we've been experiencing recently, a biological entity that is passed from person to person, becomes contagious, easily acquired by various people. Well, the same thing happens in a social context as well, that some people, more people than you might think, are susceptible to acting on the basis of something they've seen, and it gets to where it becomes just, you know, a raging pandemic of inappropriate social behavior.
I think a parallel to that would be what happens when people get, when there's a mob that starts rampaging, and people's willingness to do things under that spell of sorts but they're modeling the, you know, somebody's modeling it, and then everybody just says, let's break some things.
Yeah. And I think that probably comes about because we are social animals. Humans are social animals, and so we have a strong built-in evolutionary desire to be with the group, and a lot of times that means that whatever someone else is doing, you get a few people doing it, it's like, yeah, I'm part of the group, so I'll do it too.
Yeah.
But it's a very emotional thing, so you don't, sometimes you, it's not just a simple matter of, well, no, that's not my values, I'm not going to do that. It's not that simple. Sometimes there's that deeply embedded, which I think we'll get to this later, but the deeply embedded, evolutionarily derived tendency that's pushing us to act with the group because we fear not being part of it.
Yeah, and there's research, and I'm sure you're aware of this, that in a laboratory they can create groups by something as thin as giving a bunch of dots and having people estimate the number of them, and then you create groups by saying, oh, you overestimated, you're in the overestimation group. And so independent of what they actually said, you're underestimated, you know. And just by that, they then took those people, you were in the overestimated, and this person over here in the underestimated group, and that created some of this pool of group competition. And so when they had later a chance to distribute money, mm-hmm. within the group, right. they would actually choose the option of giving themselves less if they could give way less to the other group.
They were inclined to punish the person in the other group.
Yes.
Even though it was over something as trivially as estimating the number of dots, and you said it wasn't even accurate feedback they were receiving.
No, they just manipulated that part.
So it was totally had nothing to do with their ability to...
So that's frightening how quickly we get into that group defense and identification.
One thing that I don't know so much about, I hope we can get into it, but if not, it's certainly an interesting question, is when it comes to the ease with which we identify with and form into groups, we've been talking about it in negative terms. What about with positive, you know, influences? Do you know of anything on that?
Well, I think it would have a mirror sort of tendency, but some of these negative parts of groups don't ignite until there is competition. You know, you could live in a town and these two teams, one's in a different league and this, and you could like them both. They don't compete against each other. But they start competing against each other, you're apt to chase one or the other and become real loyal to that.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And then it becomes hogs versus horns, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Or hogs versus tide, whatever we're doing now. Okay. Well, anyway, that's one of the key influences from what I've seen in terms of polarization in our country is the influence of leaders and media figures and how they behave. That's important because when people see that, they're picking up lessons from that. One of the, incidentally, things about that research is that social modeling learning effect is drastically reduced if the person who models the behavior subsequently is seen getting punished for it. So if they do something and it doesn't work out well for them, then that tends to inhibit the populace at large or just whoever's observing it acting similarly to what they observe. So that's one of the reasons why it might be important that people who violate norms of society in some way get punished, castigated, shunned, shown disapproval, something like that.
Well, in years past, the moderate group, if people started wandering out too far to the left or right, they'd vote them out of office.
Yeah.
But there's not enough moderates now to do that.
So we don't have the punishment that way. Let's talk about another kind of influence on polarization. This one's huge. We could go all day on it, but we won't. But media influences. One of the things that seems to have happened, and I hate to keep talking about how old Jerry and I are, but we do remember back when you had three or four networks, you know, and that was it. And that's what you saw on TV. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have cable. It was all a broadcast, and you picked it up over your antenna. So everybody was exposed to Walter Cronkite or someone like that.
Yeah.
It was very different. At that time, you didn't have too much media, so everybody in media, all the different networks, tried to play to the common denominators. They kept it simple and safe. They didn't have any real outlandish notions because that would not appeal to enough people, and everybody would go to the other, you know, two or three channels.
Yeah.
So that's no longer the case, obviously. We've got so many sources of media that it has led to not only lower journalistic standards so that just about anybody can be a journalist now, and one could argue that's what we're doing now with this podcast. But that lower standard means more people out there acting in ways that a good, sound journalist who's practicing good journalistic standards would not do. And another part of that is the notion that more of what happens now is monetized. That is, in the media, you get money and income from advertising if people are following you. And the more you people follow you, the more money you get. That's true whether you're talking about television, cable, podcasts, YouTube, you know, you name it. And so, well, nothing we'll get into, but the notion of emotional reactions tends to elicit interest. It increases engagement. So it goes back to that. Some of you may have heard this old saying about news: if it bleeds, it leads. Remember that?
Yeah.
And so it's basically saying that anything in media that you see that arouses strong emotions, particularly like fear or anger, that serves as a danger signal. It triggers your survival instinct, the fight-flight response, that primitive part of your brain, and that tends to make you start to think more in terms of survival. Even though there's no true survival there, it still is arousing emotion. And basically, the fight-flight response that's meant for survival is the same area of the brain that's involved with emotions. So you get emotions involved, you get more people paying attention to it because of those ancient evolutionary tendencies.
Yeah.
So if you can arouse anger, you know, in a bunch of people, then guess what? You get paid more. So we have more problems with that now.
Well, and unfortunately, you get more votes.
Yeah.
For politicians.
That's true. Same thing. Not only do you get more money, you get more votes. Yeah, that's right. And you probably get more people volunteering to help your campaign too, right?
Well, and there's also research I think you're probably aware of that if a politician is able to tap into anger, invite people to be angry at those scoundrels in the other party, the followers that hear that tend to be more loyal to that person, and it divides them further into us them.
So. Yeah, that's sad. You know, another thing about the emotional state and being kind of caught up in emotion and getting into kind of the more primitive way of responding because of the survival instincts that are in operation in the brain, that seems to make people more vulnerable to manipulation, which is why there's that age-old problem of propaganda. People have known this for a long time before they did research on it, that if you can arouse people's fear and anger, you can get them, they're more easily manipulated. And I think in a way what's going on there is because it's appealing to a more primitive part of the brain, and it's a part of the brain that's very good at what it does, helping us survive the fight flight thing, but it's not so good at making rational decisions and thinking things through. It starts to, in a way, kind of take over, or at least it's a stronger urge than the urge to have a thoughtful moment. And so you're vulnerable to not basically operating with your full IQ when you're emotional. Yeah. And you know, everybody knows this. You've had the times when you got afraid or angry, usually angry, at one point, and then you did something, and later on you think, what was I thinking? What? That was such a dumb thing to do. We've all had that experience. Well, it's because you weren't thinking.
Yeah.
You were reacting from that more primitive instinct. But once you had time to think about it, you realized, man, that was a dumb idea. So that, to me, is one of the eternal struggles we go through as humans, is which part's in charge, the emotional part or the rational part. They both play important roles, but it is an uphill climb to try to keep the rational part in charge. So the head over the heart is a tough fight to have.
And that may be one of the reasons that humility tends to work. It keeps us, if we're really trying to practice it, a bit in check from the emotional storm. We're not getting out there and saying, "You just said something I don't believe in," and maybe my opinion. I need to be more humble.
Okay, that's an interesting thought. So in your way of looking at humility, would be a positive stance to take in some cases.
Yeah, it would be a kind of a governor to keep it from ratcheting up real quickly. If we said, I'm humble enough to think that you could be right.
Yes. That's to me is what you're saying, the key to humility. It's not all about you. Let's look
right.
at another possibility. Could this person be right? Could they have a point? Could I be wrong? Maybe we're both wrong, but at least
yeah.
that humility, be willing to look at yourself. Yeah. That's a hard thing to do, but it's important. Yeah. Well, we're talking about media influences, and we have to say something about social media, right? So, as most everybody knows by now, social media is a really big, I mean, in some ways it's a really cool thing, but it's a really huge problem. And briefly, it's because of the algorithms in social media. Facebook is, you know, one of the key players there, and there are lots of documentaries and movies and books and papers and news articles about it. But if you look up the impact of social media algorithms, and Jerry, help me out on this if I'm getting it wrong, but basically what is happening is that the social media companies have done pretty sophisticated scientific analyses of what kinds of responses on social media are associated with high engagement, and it usually is something that makes you emotional.
Yeah.
So that if you see something on social media and it makes you angry, then you're more likely to pay attention to it and to have an opinion and to engage with that particular social media post. And that's part of the problem, but the other part of the problem is that their algorithms, they can put lots of people together who have similar responses so that they form a kind of a thought bubble. All these people who have similar responses emotionally to certain types of media posts, they keep getting fed the same things they respond to because they want more engagement, because that gets more of an audience, and somewhere along the line, more people are making money.
Right? Advertising revenue goes up.
Yeah, okay. So the algorithms, they may help people make more money out of advertising, but it also has the negative side effect of putting people into a bubble where they only hear a certain view that resonates with them.
Yeah, and there's some tendency to take people down rabbit holes, not just give them more of the same, but give them a little bloodier version of it.
Kind of
so
escalate in a more
yeah,
extreme direction.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the social media thing increases polarization. So basically, if you are, let's say you're liberal, and someone posts something that puts down a conservative politician, then that kind of gets into your tribal instincts and makes you want to respond, and you're more likely to, you know, say they like that when they're putting down that figure I don't like and don't agree with. And so that kind of, you know, then the social media algorithm says, oh, okay, I need to feed them more stuff like this from that standpoint. So everybody who thinks like you is in this big bubble supporting each other's ideas about how horrible people are on that other side and how we're right. And so it kind of hardens your opinions. and it keeps you from having alternative rational ideas from a different perspective. Well, we could go more into that, but let's move on. The other thing that is important in polarization is the information, but especially misinformation and disinformation and propaganda. So as I understand it, the difference between misinformation and disinformation, misinformation is you get exposed to something that's not true, and so you spread it because you think it's true and you think people ought to know about it, but you're innocent of your intent to deceive. Disinformation is purposefully passed along by somebody who has the intent to deceive someone to believe something that's not true. Is that your understanding?
Yeah.
Okay. And then, of course, propaganda is basically a disinformation that it's specifically designed to get, you know, the populace or a certain group of people to think a certain way to achieve a person's or a group's political ends.
Yeah.
Who was the World War II German, is that Goebbels, that was known for being kind of the propaganda chief in the Nazi regime?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and the idea is to keep saturating over and over with the erroneous notion that if you repeat it enough strongly and arouse emotion, people are going to decide that's true, you know, and that's one of the ways that propaganda works. So I think that version was something like, you know, how the horrible and evil and subhuman the Jews are. You know?
Yeah.
Well, it's been bad enough with propaganda and disinformation over the millennia, but now we have this media-rich environment. We've got the internet and technology and so many sources of information where we have ready access to incredible amounts of data and viewpoints. And that, unfortunately, means that there's a lot of bad information out there.
Well, you'll recall the Pizzagate incident?
Yeah.
The guy got all this disinformation and picked up his weapon and drove quite a few miles to go into a particular pizza parlor to shoot up the place and rescue children he thought were there getting abused.
Yeah, and he was going, it was supposed to be in the basement of this pizza place.
Yeah.
The pizza place didn't even have a basement. Yeah, I know. There are lots of examples of that, and I guarantee you, you'll see that all the time. One of the things that is helpful is when you find sources that identify particularly egregious disinformation and educate you about that. One of the things I think is really good here in Little Rock these days, the Arkansas Democrat Gazette every Sunday has, I forget what it's called, but it's basically news that's wrong. you know, it's kind of a highlight of some of the key things in the last week that came up that just aren't true, and it gives a pretty good, thorough explanation of what the original assertion was in the media and why it's wrong and what the truth is.
Well, Alex Jones, one of the biggest, you know, disinformation propagators, his net worth is over $100 million. And he's made it all by selling products, by getting people first to look at him, then he sells them something.
And the way he gets them to look at him is to...
Yeah, is to excite him.
With really wrong but scandalous, outrageous, hateful,
fear-mongering
kinds of...
There's no low point he won't go to.
Yeah. And by the way, so this is... He's on the right, I believe you'd agree. So this is true regardless of what your political view is. You know, there are people who provide disinformation from the left as well. We won't get into who does what and how much of each, but certainly this is a tendency that regardless of your viewpoint, it does happen.
Right.
And it operates whichever side of the political spectrum.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. So some of the things that maybe are important to think about is when we consume information from our current media environment, because a lot of it is fairly questionable, we're going to have to do a lot better job of developing good media hygiene. You know how we've got taught good dental hygiene. Be sure to brush your teeth, you know, regularly and floss and that sort of thing. Well, the same thing in my mind needs to happen these days about media consumption. We need to get more people used to the idea that we have to learn how to look at media and use some thoughtfulness about what we're consuming, make sure we're getting good quality information, learn how to recognize the bad stuff, and get a variety of quality information. So to me, that is one of the things that needs to happen.
It's kind of like a balanced diet.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we need a balanced diet of healthy stuff. If all we eat is sugar and, you know, alcohol, then, you know.
Yeah,
we get the idea. Okay. Now, here's another thought. The way the brain works, and Jerry, let me see if you'd agree with this. The brain, it's a little harder to operate at higher levels of thoughtfulness and rationality. But is that a reasonable stance to take, that all things else considered, the brain is more likely to respond readily and easily to something that's kind of emotional and not very thoughtful?
And just shortcuts and heuristics as well.
Yeah, which I think we'll get into later. So emotionally charged material is going to be more persuasive, and it has the tendency to crowd out the rational, balanced information. So you have to spend more time and energy and make more of a commitment and think about, make a purposeful commitment to thinking things through, because if you're just casually scrolling through your social media on your phone and you just go with whatever strikes you, your impulse at the time, you're probably consuming a lot of stuff that's highly emotionally laden and is therefore not going to be as likely to have good, accurate information available to you.
Sure.
And then the other thing about media is just how much of it's polarized. I think we mentioned that a little bit last time. We've got so many ways to provide media information to people that now just about any viewpoint you can think about, you can find lots of information there. And so you've got people who are saying, okay, I know I'm going to make my money out of, and then insert your favorite horrible way of looking at some group. Or, you know.
Yeah.
And the other thing about polarization is it tends to really have an impact on people with extreme views, and it tends to make our views over time more extreme. And one of the things we know from research is that people who have extreme views are more susceptible to believing disinformation, particularly if it's said against the other group that they don't like.
Yeah, and politicians know that.
Yeah. Thanks to our listeners for joining us for this edition of On the Other Hand. We hope you enjoyed this part of our discussion on polarization with Jerry Henderson. Be sure to check out the rest of our conversation and future podcast episodes of On the Other Hand on the Braver Angels Arkansas website. That address is arkansas.braverangels.org, and you just go to the podcast page from there. We'd like to hear from our listeners. We'd like to know what feedback you have for us, what you like about our program, any suggestions you have for improvement, especially any ideas for speakers or topics that you'd like to see us cover. But basically, whatever you want to share with us, all you got to do is just email it to us. So if you go to the Braver Angels Arkansas website, on the podcast page, you will find a link to send us a Gmail, and that email address is otherhandar@gmail.com. That's otherhandar@gmail.com. On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band, Dr. Richard Main, conductor. From your host, Glenn White, have a good evening, and let's keep the conversation going as we work to bring our community closer together.